In the year 1837, British antiquarian and pyramid explorer Colonel Richard William Howard Vyse, a man driven as much by ambition as by curiosity, arrived at Giza and began his exploration of the ancient monuments there, in particular the Great Pyramid, which in his later three-volume book, Operations at Giza, the British pyramid explorer laid claim to a dramatic discovery, the forced entry using gunpowder into four previously unknown sealed chambers nestled high above the King's Chamber within the monument. These cramped, hidden spaces contained something extraordinary. Scrawled in red ochre paint across wall and angled ceiling blocks were crude hieroglyphs, markings that Colonel Vyse heralded as ancient workers' inscriptions or simply quarry marks. Significantly, among these markings, we are told, were found the various royal names of the Old Kingdom pharaoh Khufu, the very king whom mainstream Egyptology has long credited as the builder of the Great Pyramid around 2550 BCE. Modern scholars interpret these marks not as declarations by royal decree, but as rudimentary tags, designations of work gangs applied to the stone blocks destined for the so-called stress-relieving chambers. And because these painted marks were claimed to lie within chambers sealed since antiquity, the so-called quarry marks have, for nearly two centuries, stood as the cornerstone of the conventional narrative that Khufu commissioned and oversaw the construction of the Great Pyramid as his eternal tomb. The significance and weight of Vyse's claimed discovery is recognised by most scholars, including leading American Egyptologist Dr. Mark Lehner, who states,
"Since nobody had entered from the time Khufu's workmen sealed it until Vyse blasted his way in, the gang names clinch the attribution of this pyramid to the 4th dynasty pharaoh, Khufu."
With this discovery, Colonel Vyse handed Egyptology key evidence that helped cement the Tomb of the Pharaoh narrative of the pyramids for almost the next 200 years. However, to this day, as far as can be determined, no official scientific analysis has ever been carried out on the painted inscriptions within the four Vyse chambers. These enigmatic marks, central to the accepted narrative that attributes the Great Pyramid to the pharaoh Khufu, remain astonishingly untested by the analytical tools of modern science. The lack of scientific transparency over these painted inscriptions has become increasingly troubling, particularly given that doubts over their assumed authenticity emerged almost as soon as Colonel Vyse published his discovery to the world in 1840. These accusations, long relegated to the margins of historical research, have never fully disappeared. On the contrary, they persist to this day, like an open sore, gaining traction as new anomalies are uncovered and unanswered questions relating to them begin to pile ever higher. The assumed authenticity of the chamber markings rests primarily on one simple fact. In 1837, very few scholars understood ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs, and fewer still the hieratic style of writing that Colonel Vyse claimed to have found within the chambers. The reasoning was simple. If the scholars of the day didn't understand hieratic inscriptions, how on earth would it have been possible for any layperson, including Colonel Vyse, to have understood them to produce so convincing a hoax? This assumed authenticity, however, is easily countered. Colonel Vyse, by his own admission, possessed and had read early Egyptological textbooks, and he reportedly copied hieroglyphs extensively during his time in Egypt. While this almost certainly could not have given him much understanding of the ancient hieratic script, it does suggest a methodical eye and a collector's mindset, precisely the qualities required not to invent, but to replicate. And that brings us to the most intriguing possibility of all. What if the Colonel didn't forge these inscriptions from imagination? How could he? But simply copied them, not from a book, but from somewhere else. Intriguingly, on the 2nd of May 1837, Colonel Vyse records in his published book the discovery of genuine painted quarry marks, ancient inscriptions on stone blocks he was clearing from rubble heaps outside the Great Pyramid.
2nd May, red quarry marks were continually found upon the stones that were removed at the southern front of the Great Pyramid.
And we know that the Colonel absolutely did copy these rubble pile markings, since in his private account of this same event, he writes,
2nd of May, copied the painted markings from the stone blocks at the Great Pyramid's southern front.
Astonishingly, however, in Colonel Vyse's official account, he presents the painted markings from just one of these external rubble pile stones, and as such must represent one of the most peculiar actions ever to have occurred in the long history of the Great Pyramid's exploration. What happened to those other rubble pile stones and their ancient quarry markings the Colonel tells us he was continually finding? Colonel Vyse does not say, but perhaps revealingly in his private account he writes,
"Blasted the stones on Great Pyramid's north side."
Markings from just one stone, just one drawing, just one solitary record of what would almost certainly have been a treasure trove of highly prized, authentic Old Kingdom quarry markings scattered throughout the rubble piles at the foot of the very monument the British pyramid explorer was so obsessed with. But it was more than just an obsession, for the Colonel tells us in his accounts that he was determined to make an important discovery before returning home to England. In particular, he wanted to find the true burial chamber of Khufu. In the end, having spent a considerable amount of his own personal fortune, this proved to be elusive. But still, all might not be lost. Having access to a cache of genuine ancient markings that he kept secret, the question that arises now is this. Did Colonel Vyse do the unthinkable? Did he use these external rubble pile quarry marks and simply replicate them into the chambers he had just blasted his way into? In short, did Colonel Vyse perpetrate the hoax of all history? A careful examination of the clues, scattered like jigsaw pieces across diverse sources, points not to just a vague possibility, but to a startling likelihood that this may well be the case. The evidence, once we dare to confront it, is compelling. Let us now follow where that evidence leads. This investigation begins with two independent witness statements that essentially imply that a fraud was indeed perpetrated inside the Great Pyramid in 1837. The first of these allegations was made by a Prussian prince, Hermann von Puckler, Moscow, who had met Colonel Vyse at Giza during his own travels through Egypt at the time. In his 1847 account of his travels, the Prussian prince published the following barely concealed accusation of fraud against Vyse, who in 1846 had been promoted to the rank of Major General.
"The hieroglyphics which Major Wise pretends to have just discovered in the Great Pyramid are not cut in the stone, but merely drawn on the wall, and perhaps recently too with a finger dipped in colour."
While the basis of the Prussian prince's allegation is uncertain, what may be telling is that it was never publicly challenged by Colonel Vyse. The second witness was a man named Humphreys Brewer, who apparently worked for Vyse at Giza in 1837. From letters passed down to Brewer's great-great-grandson, Walter Allen of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, it seems that Brewer witnessed fraud occurring at Giza while working for Colonel Weiss. Walter Allen presents Brewer's allegation in the following brief account he learned from an elderly relative in 1954.
Yes, it's all here. It says, had dispute with Raven and Hill about painted marks in the pyramid. Faint marks were repainted, some were new. Did not find tomb.
From other family letters, it seems that the unfortunate man was then removed from the colonel's employment and banned from the Giza site. Although these letters have since been lost to time, partial corroboration of Brewer's claim may come from no less an authority than Colonel Weiss himself. In his private journal entry of May 10, 1837, the colonel writes about a dispute in his camp between Mr. Raven and another man named Morrity. He goes on to explain how he then sacked Morrity. Thereafter, he writes about a walk he made with Sir Robert and Lady Arbuthnot. While Colonel Weiss does not state here the nature of this dispute, it is evidently significant enough that he sacked the man named Morrity, who was, in fact, the colonel's long-time personal servant. And, somewhat bizarrely, the colonel failed to write a single word of this particular dispute in his published account, even though he wrote of a number of other significant disputes in his camp. In Weiss's brief account, there are clear parallels with the account of Humphreys Brewer. It seems, however, that it was not Brewer who'd been fired by Weiss, as the Allen family account seems to suggest, but rather Weiss's own servant. And if the two accounts do refer to the same dispute, as seems likely, then Morrity's sacking seems to have been the result of him accusing Mr. Raven, possibly also Mr. Hill, of placing fake markings into the pyramid. Within the topmost of the vice chambers, Campbell's chamber, we find some ancient Egyptian numbers have been painted onto some roof blocks. These numbers are peculiar for a couple of reasons. First of all, unlike every other hieratic inscription in all of the four vice chambers that have been written correctly from right to left, we find that these numbers have been painted from left to right, effectively back to front. This is highly peculiar for hieratic numbers, since they are almost always written from right to left. Secondly, the numbers have been written in a hieroglyphic rather than hieratic style, which, again, is unusual. It almost seems as though these numbers were painted by someone who did not understand the difference between hieroglyphic numbers and hieratic numbers, perhaps learning and copying from an early book on hieroglyphs such as Wilkinson's Materia Hieroglyphica, published in 1828, which gives examples of hieroglyphic numbers written from left to right. In 2025, during an interview in the Matt Beale Limitless podcast, Dr. Zahi Hawass revealed to the world new chamber markings that had been found by the World Scan Project. Apparently, these markings are not visible to the naked eye and were only detected through the use of state-of-the-art 3D digital scanning technology. Here's how Dr. Hawass revealed this discovery.
And recently, we used 3D. With 3D, we're able to record about three more names, like the gangs who are connected with the goddess Wadjet, and Wadjet was the goddess that connected with the king. We have another name, the good god. And the most important, in room number three and room number four, we found the names year 13 of Khufu's reign, mentioned year 13.
And so the original cartouche was discovered there in the early part of the 19th century?
Yes.
Yeah. And so there was some debate on whether or not that could be a forgery, but now you're saying that they've discovered, that you've discovered three more cartouches.
Before we consider the dates that Dr. Hawass tells us were discovered, let us first correct the comment here by Matt, who states that three more cartouches were found. This is a misunderstanding by Matt. Dr. Hawass merely states that new gang names were found. He does not say anything about these names being held within a cartouche that would indicate a royal name. Here we can observe the new names that were detected by the World Scan team, and we can easily observe that neither of them are contained within the distinctive royal cartouche, and are certainly not any names of Khufu. But back now to the dates mentioned by Dr. Hawass. The first of these dates is highlighted here in the red dashed box. We'll rotate it so that we can view it in its proper upright orientation. The first thing we notice about these dates is their composition, which is of a style more usually observed in later Middle Kingdom dates than those typically from the 4th dynasty. When we now consider each of the hieroglyphic signs, we find an odd contradiction. This first sign from the right represents the word year, and the three small strokes to the left are the number 3. The sign above the three digits is the solar disk sign, indicating that this group of signs is a date. For this date to become year 13 requires the addition of another sign, the sign for the number 10. The inclusion of this sign would then make the date year 13. Its absence means the date is year 3. The second date, shown here in box 1, was found in Nelson's chamber and is no less problematic. Here we observe the date rotated to upright and enlarged. According to Dr. Hawass, these markings represent year 13. Presumably here he is doubling the 6 years shown in the date as a cattle count, an event that occurred every 2 years in ancient Egypt. Thus he arrives at year 13. However, there is no obvious presence in this date of the signs that would indicate this date was, in fact, a cattle count. As such, this date should be understood not as year 13, but simply as year 6. How is it possible that we can find a stone painted with year 3 of Khufu's reign at a height of the Great Pyramid where the monument is around 70% complete? Egyptologists believe it took over 20 years to build the Great Pyramid. Constructing so much of the monument in just 3 years is surely not even remotely possible. Secondly, why are the dates reversed? If we accept that the pyramid and its chambers were built in order, bottom upwards, surely the lower chamber, Nelson's, should have the earlier year of Khufu's reign, and the upper chamber, Lady Arbuthnot's, the later year. These inverted dates suggest the pyramid core was constructed from top to bottom, which, of course, is simply not possible. Are we perhaps seeing here the work of a forger who didn't understand these inscriptions and how they could betray his attempted hoax? In his private journal, Colonel Weiss makes several drawings of the Khufu cartouche that he is supposed to have copied from the roof block in Campbell's chamber. However, when we study the Colonel's sketches of these cartouches carefully, we find that he presents all the Khufu cartouches from his journal horizontally, whereas the actual cartouche on the chamber roof block has been painted sideways. This contrary orientation appears quite deliberate by Weiss, since it is supported by the cartouche drawing made by his assistant, Mr. Hill, who also drew the cartouche with a horizontal rather than sideways orientation. Colonel Weiss tasked his assistant, Mr. Hill, to make facsimile copies of the chamber markings. To record the actual orientation of each block's markings onto his facsimile sheet, Mr. Hill used his own signature as a "this way up" indicator, a fact verified by statistical analysis of his work, whereby 25 of his 28 drawings conform to this scheme. This is a statistical probability certainty of almost 100% that Mr. Hill used this system. And if this is so, as seems to be the case, it effectively proves that the original source of the Khufu cartouche drawn by Hill and Weiss had been aligned horizontally when they first copied it. It seems that when Hill's drawing was later used to copy the cartouche into the chamber, the forger rotated the drawing 90 degrees, failing to realise that Hill's signature had already locked in the orientation of the original master source. Lady Arbuthnot's chamber has more hieroglyphs, including royal names, than all the other chambers combined. If you were to enter the chamber today with just a simple candle or torch, you'd be able to see many of the painted markings upon its walls. It is peculiar then that when this chamber was first opened and explored in 1837 by Colonel Weiss, assisted by Mr. Raven, two sets of eyes, not a single quarry mark was discovered in this chamber by either of the men. This is highly strange for several reasons. One, the two men were actively examining the walls, noting that they were similar to the chambers below, though less well constructed. Two, Colonel Weiss had, by this time, supposedly discovered quarry markings in the two lower chambers, so would surely now have been primed and anticipating finding more markings upon the walls of this new chamber and actively seeking them. Three, the two men were measuring the chamber, thus in no particular hurry. It wasn't, in fact, until 3 days later that painted markings in this chamber are said to have been found, apparently after another, more forensic examination of its walls. This begs the obvious question. Why was it so difficult for two men in 1837 to observe a single one of this chamber's plethora of painted wall markings when today, with just a simple torch or candle, many of them can be easily observed? If they are easily observed today, why not also in 1837? Especially when the two men had been primed to look for them. This 3 day gap is peculiar for other reasons. Inside Lady Arbuthnot's chamber, the dedication inscription on the chamber wall clearly records the opening date as 9th May 1837. This date is reinforced by Mr. Hill's 6 facsimile drawings of the painted markings, ostensibly from this chamber, each one repeating that the chamber was opened on the 9th of May. But this is not true. John Perring, who worked alongside Weiss and published his own account a year earlier than Weiss, states plainly that the chamber was opened on the 6th of May 1837, 3 days earlier. So, once again, we encounter a 3 day anomaly in the Giza timeline. First, the chamber appears empty of markings, then, 3 days later, on the very date recorded in the chamber's dedication inscription, markings are suddenly discovered. Was this Weiss's plan all along, to make the chamber's opening and the discovery of the markings coincide with each other, neatly erasing the awkward 3 day gap? If so, it backfired. In his book, Weiss conceded the true opening date, 6th of May, probably because Perring had already published it. Yet to this day, the chamber's dedication inscription and Hill's drawings still proclaim the opening date as 9th of May. To paper over this clear contradiction, Weiss went so far as to misrepresent the chamber's dedication inscription in his published account, altering it to read 6th of May. In the end, the very discrepancy Weiss sought to erase came back to haunt him, worsened by his double deception. What was meant to tidy up the record instead left behind what appears to be traces of a botched hoax and attempted cover-up. Within the Vice Chambers, a highly bizarre phenomenon can be observed. Various hieroglyphs that were upon the chamber walls in 1837 disappeared from those walls shortly afterward. We find the evidence of this in the various drawings of the markings made by the surveyors from the time. But stranger still is that all of the markings that vanished from the chamber walls were mistakes, signs that in their particular setting were clearly wrong and should never have been present upon the chamber wall. We are not concerned here with the stylistic differences between each of the artists as they copied the markings from the chamber walls. What interests us here is only the significant differences, the missing signs in the comparative drawings of each artist. The first sign we observe on screen is from Nelson's chamber. The sign in the dashed box is drawn by Mr. Hill, but here we see that in Mr. Perring's drawing of the same group of signs, it has now vanished. This sign is anomalous and should never have been present because it is not part of this particular set group of signs. The second sign we observe is from Lady Arbuthnot's chamber. The sign in the dashed box is drawn here by Mr. Perring, but once again, the sign vanishes from the chamber wall by the time Mr. Hill comes round to drawing it. This sign is also anomalous for a couple of reasons. It's only upside down sign on this stone, and it's an unnecessary duplicate sign. And finally, we observe this sign in the dashed box, also from Lady Arbuthnot's chamber. It is clearly present in Mr. Perring's drawing, but has vanished in Alan Rowe's later drawing of it in 1931. This sign is also anomalous for a couple of reasons. First, it has been painted onto the wrong side of the chamber. And secondly, it has been mixed with another different gang name on the same chamber wall block. Only one gang name should ever be expected on any wall block. The probability of this outcome, three anomalous signs all disappearing by random chance, is vanishingly small, with a probability certainty of almost 100% that human agency was involved in the deliberate selection and removal of the anomalous, now vanished, signs. What this suggests is that when painting these markings upon the chamber walls, the forger had made three false starts, three mistakes. He departed the chamber to find a tool to remove the mistakes, but in his absence, the marks were copied by others, thereby creating the discrepancy we observe today with these missing markings. As we previously saw, when making his first couple of drawings of the Khufu cartouche, ostensibly from Campbell's chamber of the Great Pyramid, Colonel Weiss, in his first two attempts, failed to draw any of the lines in the cartouche disc. This is a highly peculiar omission because we can see that the Colonel was very careful to draw the tiny detail of the two dots under the snake sign in the cartouche. If he was detail aware enough to copy such tiny detail, why not also the three lines in the cartouche disc? And if he could place two small dots within the cartouche disc in his first attempt, why not the three lines? It almost seems as though the three lines were not present within the disc at that time. It is only, in fact, upon his third and final attempt on the 16th of June 1837, weeks after supposedly discovering this cartouche in the chamber, that the colonel finally draws it properly with the three small lines within the disc. What this suggests is that the cartouche had been copied from its original source, where it had been observed with just a blank disc, hence why it was copied like this into the chamber. However, in early June, Mr. Perrin sent Weiss copies of other Khufu cartouches from a tomb to the west of the Great Pyramid, and in these versions, the disc within the cartouche had lines. On the 16th of June, Weiss also went to this tomb, it seems for the purpose of undertaking a comparative study of the Khufu cartouche. What the colonel found there appears to have convinced him that the Khufu cartouche that had been upon the wall of Campbell's chamber at that time with just a blank disc was wrong, and that three horizontal lines needed to be added to the disc to ensure the correct spelling of Khufu. Remarkably, in his private journal of 16th June 1837, there is a handwritten page which apparently presents the colonel's deliberation over the correct spelling of the Khufu cartouche, which we will now see in the following reconstruction of the relevant page section. Since the makers of this documentary were refused permission to use the original journal page, which remains under copyright until 2039, a reconstruction of the relevant page section became necessary. First of all, onto the page, he places a copy of the Khufu cartouche, as it was at that time in Campbell's chamber, with just a blank disc. He will use this as his comparative drawing when at the tomb. In the bottom left margin of the page, he draws a second duplicate Khufu cartouche. This will be his working copy of the cartouche that he will edit as necessary to create his final version. Next, he places a small cross above the discs in both copies of the cartouche, highlighting the specific sign he wants to check when at the tomb for his comparative study. At the tomb, he finds a Khufu cartouche that is different to the Khufu cartouche in the pyramid. It has three horizontal lines in the disc, which he draws in the journal page margin. The colonel now places a large cross mark through the base of his working copy cartouche, indicating the cartouche with the blank disc is wrong and that it needs to have three lines added to the disc. In his working copy of the Khufu cartouche, the colonel then places another disc with three small lines inside his blank cartouche disc. This working copy Khufu cartouche now has a disc within a disc and is the only disc of five on the page to have a double lined disc. All other discs on the page are drawn with only a single outline. Having made his change to the cartouche disc, the colonel now cross-references the edit by placing a small vertical stroke just to the right of both lined disc, basically keeping a record of the change he had made. Finally, Weiss gives his working copy cartouche the label Cartouche in Campbell's Chamber and, revealingly, places a double vertical stroke beneath the label. This was his Mark II version, his latest and final Khufu cartouche. This change would then be replicated to the actual chamber cartouche and also to Mr. Hill's drawing of it before it was sent by Weiss to the academics at the British Museum. In his private journal entry of the 27th of May 1837, Colonel Weiss makes a truly explosive comment. This was the day he had just opened Campbell's chamber, the very chamber in which he would later claim was found the iconic Khufu cartouche. In his journal description of this momentous occasion, He describes the chamber's general condition in great detail, but remarkably does this without ever mentioning the presence of any quarry marks upon the chamber walls. He does mention some marks, crosses and triangles he observed on the chamber's floor blocks, which he draws on the journal page. However, the most sensational and, it has to be said, damning revelation of all is the following short comment. "These were my marks from cartouche to inscribe over any plane." The final words in the sentence are uncertain, but may be the words low trussing or roof trussing, which are the angular shaped roof blocks in Campbell's chamber where we find the Khufu cartouche has been placed. Though some words in this brief passage are uncertain, what seems fairly clear are the words cartouche to inscribe. Future tense. Weiss does not write inscribed, past tense. This was a task that was yet to be carried out in this chamber, a Khufu cartouche to be copied onto a roof trussing. This image on screen is an impression of one of Mr. Hill's facsimile drawings. It seems typical of the other 27 drawings made by him of the markings in the four vice chambers, but there is something very wrong with this drawing. Bizarrely, it is nowhere to be found in any of the vice chambers of the Great Pyramid. According to two past surveys and the 2025 survey by the World Scan Project, this group of markings simply does not exist. There is a group of signs in Campbell's chamber that resemble what is believed to be the group of signs on Mr. Hill's phantom fax. However, on three separate metrics, it can be established fairly conclusively that the two groups of signs are not, in fact, one and the same. The first main difference we observe between the two sets of signs are their orientation. While the signs on the chamber wall are oriented vertically, Mr. Hill's drawing has the markings aligned horizontally, in line with his signature convention that locked in the orientation of each group of markings when he originally observed and copied them. The second main difference we find between the two groups of signs is their scale. Colonel Weiss had instructed Mr. Hill to make one-to-one copies of the wall markings. However, by using other comparative drawings made by both Pering and Hill, it has been established that the markings on Mr. Hill's phantom fact sheet are around twice as large as those on the wall. The third and final major difference we find between the two groups of signs is their centre sign. They are significantly different to each other. Critically here, both signs are valid, recognisable hieratic signs. One isn't simply a poor rendition of the other. In short, this group of signs, according to several surveys, simply does not exist anywhere inside the Great Pyramid. All of which, of course, begs the obvious question. If this group of markings do not exist in any pyramid chamber, where exactly did Mr. Hill copy them from? What may have happened is that the forger, while copying Hill's facsimile drawings into the chambers, simply overlooked copying this particular sheet onto any of the chamber walls. Mr. Hill's phantom facsimile, which can be viewed in the British Museum, strongly suggests that an external source of markings, presumably the same markings Colonel Weiss was continually finding in the pyramid's external rubble piles, was used to replicate into the pyramid's internal chambers. The great irony here, of course, is that the fraudsters appear to have become unstuck not by what they did copy, but by what they didn't. Forgery, deception and cover-up buried deep inside the Great Pyramid of Giza. The clues of this audacious fraud are plentiful in eyewitness accounts, in ink and ochre, in falsified dates, in expedient journal entries and edits, in vanished glyphs, and in markings that do not exist, and yet they somehow do. And the deeper one digs, the clearer the picture becomes. The 1837 discovery of these chamber markings, including the iconic Khufu cartouche, may in fact be the greatest archaeological forgery of all time, the hoax of all history. With Colonel Vyse's dubious actions at Giza now exposed, the corrupting influence of the quarry marks he claimed to have found within the pyramid should now be set aside. And when we do that, we find ourselves gazing at these monuments from antiquity through a very different lens. Suddenly, the door to our prehistory opens and a very different story for these monuments begins to emerge. An ancient truth rises up from under the rubble of Colonel Vyse's Victorian lie. When we strip away those layers of deceit and distraction and listen instead to the ancient voices calling to us across the ages, we begin to hear their story, an older, extraordinary and infinitely more profound story, calling to us still across the void of time, waiting to be seen, to be understood, to be remembered. And now, after nearly two centuries of distraction, that story is finally ready to be told.
This video presentation is based on the work of author and independent researcher Scott Creighton. Discover the full shocking story of the events at Giza in 1837 and how they suppressed and distorted the truth of our ancient past in his new book, The Great Pyramid Hoax 2, available now from Amazon.com and from all good bookstores.